This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yeis Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Well, we have two different tragedies that have emerged today. At least four migrants drowned and others unaccounted for in a new tragedy off the coast of Greece, near the island of Crete. In a second incident, the Italian Red Cross said 117 immigrants had died when their dinghy sank near Zuara off the coast of Libya.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna describing the latest boat tragedies as migrants continue to attempt a treacherous journey across the Mediterranean with the hope of reaching Europe. We'll have full details coming up.
Also, 5 years after war broke out in Sudan's South Kordofan state, the UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of people are continuing to flee the region.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, tragedies at sea continue as migrants make the treacherous journey across the Mediterranean in an attempt to reach Europe. Beginning yesterday, nearly 120 bodies, all Africans, have begun washing ashore in western Libya. Also today, 340 migrants were rescued off Crete, but four were found dead. In related news, the International Organization for Migration, IOM, released figures on the number of arrivals in Europe by sea, including the number of unaccompanied children so far this year. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following developments of the migrant situation. From Rome, she spoke with me about the latest boat tragedies, as well as the latest figures on migrants who have reached Europe in 2016.
Well, we have two different tragedies that have emerged today. At least four migrants drowned and others unaccounted for in a new tragedy off the coast of Greece. Near the island of Crete, a boat carrying hundreds of immigrants capsized overnight, and rescue teams have been moving in to save people's lives. Around 342 immigrants were rescued and four dead bodies have been recovered from this fishing boat that capsized. It's believed to have left Egypt en route to Italy. In a second incident, the Italian Red Cross said 117 immigrants had died when their dinghy sank near Zuara off the coast of Libya. And the Red Cross has been recovering bodies on the beach there. Dozens of women and also children are among those who are said to be in an advanced state of decomposition. We're not sure when their boat sank, but it's possible that it was last week or a few days ago when we had a string of disasters there in the Mediterranean.
When there's something tragic like this in their bodies that are being recovered or being washed up on the shore, are there people that come and claim them? What happens?
It's almost impossible to identify many of these bodies because they are identified as Africans. So the Red Cross said they've come from other countries. They've made their crossing probably from Libya or Egypt. And the idea, the concept of actually tracing the families would be next to impossible because most of them would have no identity papers on them anyway. So the chances of actually locating their families seems close to impossible, I would say.
There have been some figures released showing the number of arrivals in Europe this year so far. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, the Organization for International Migration, which tallies the figures, has released figures today saying that 205,509 immigrants arrived in Europe by sea just this year, and more than 2,000, around 2,440, were either dead or missing. And that's quite a high number. We've seen 47,000 arrivals in Italy, but the Italian government is saying don't get too worried about that figure because it's similar to what the number of people that arrived here last year. Still, it's a high number, and the Italian Coast Guard, the Italian Navy, and other vessels are on alert in the Mediterranean to make sure that there are no more deaths from mishaps as people make this perilous journey, and they're continuing to come.
I understand there's still more and more unaccompanied children who are making this treacherous journey. So what condition are they in when they arrive?
Authorities say there's been a dramatic increase in the number of children who are arriving. Around 7,700 have landed in Italy this year. 6,800 were unaccompanied. Now, that's a lot of children. And Save the Children, the organization, is very concerned about that. They say it's 3 times higher than what they saw in 2015 during the same period. Many of them are very shaken, shocked, in poor health when they arrive, and they're also distrustful of authorities. And there's concern that they're going to be susceptible to great risk, to exploitation, to human slavery, human trafficking. Some even end up in prison, and that's a great concern. And some people here in Rome, some experts at one of the children's hospitals, have been talking about how fragile many of these children are psychologically because they've suffered such dramatic incidents crossing the Mediterranean, either with their parents or with their loved ones that they may have lost along the way, or just by the sheer experience of traveling on their own to a foreign country that they know nothing about.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome.
Five years after war broke out in Sudan's South Kordofan state, the UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of people are continuing to flee the region, with most heading for South Sudan. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
As South Kordofan prepares to mark the 5th anniversary of war on Sunday, the UN Refugee Agency reports no let-up in the number of people fleeing the region. In the lead-up to South Sudan's independence in 2011, conflict erupted between Sudan's government and a rebel movement, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North. The UN Refugee Agency reports the problems that were pushing people to flee their homes back then continue to this day. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says so far this year, more than 7,500 refugees have crossed the border to Yida in South Sudan's Unity State, already home to some 70,000 refugees. He says thousands more are expected to arrive in the coming weeks as the conflict in South Kordofan intensifies.
From the refugees, we're hearing of escalating violence, talk of ground attacks, aerial bombings, the recent arrival. We're also citing lack of food, no access to schools for their children. This seems to be especially acute in and around the Umdurain area. Most people, Yida, are arriving by trucks. Some are coming by foot or by bicycle, many travelling for about a week or so to reach there.
Refugees are reporting the conflict in South Kordofan has shifted to the northeast, and some people have become trapped and are unable to escape. The UNHCR says nearly 90% of those arriving in South Sudan are women and children. It adds a high number of children have become separated from their families during flight. The agency says the refugees are being transferred from Yida to a refugee camp in Adung Thok. It says the camp, which was established in 2013, is badly overstretched, so a new refugee camp is being set up nearby to accommodate new arrivals. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib. 14 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Tragedies at sea continue as migrants make the treacherous journey across the Mediterranean in an attempt to reach Europe. And 5 years after war broke out in Sudan's South Kordofan state, the UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of people are continuing to flee the region. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Several Libyan militias are headed to the coastal city of Sirte, which has been an Islamic State militant stronghold for 5 months. A militia from Misrata in the west is reported on the outskirts of Sirte, and the nation's Petroleum Facilities Guard is marching from the east. VOA's David Arnold reports the two forces are not alone in the effort to free Libya of Islamic State militants.
The political and military affairs of Libya have been complex and chaotic since local militias overthrew longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Libya now seeks to get rid of Islamic State forces, which have added to the turmoil. As two Libyan militias advance on Sirte, Wayne White, a Middle East Institute scholar and a former Near East researcher for the U.S. State Department, says there's a third force joining the assault. It is led by General Khalifa Haftar.
In addition, General Haftar, who has been in charge of the so-called Libyan National Army, affiliated with the Eastern, previously a recognized government of the House of Representatives, has been mobilizing his own forces and pushing westward toward the oil facilities and towards Sirte. He has been involved in some fighting in Benghazi to mop up some Islamist extremists, and then he's moved on to Ajdabiya, which is halfway to the oil terminals, and has taken control of most of Ajdabiya, and claims he is headed west also toward the oil terminals.
White describes General Haftar as one of Libya's strongest voices against the Islamic forces that have vied for power in Libya. He was a young general in Gaddafi's army until he and troops under his command were captured by the Chadian military in 1987. That ended his Libyan military career until his recent return to Libya. White says Haftar's current goals are more than the liberation of Sirte.
He seems to be making a potential power play for power in Tripoli itself. He has associated a very powerful militia from Zintan, it's a mountain area south of Tripoli, into his Libyan National Army, and reportedly, as of a few days ago, had pushed within 20 miles of the capital from the south with the objective of seizing the capital from the recognized government and expunging the former Islamist government that was there before the national accord government.
White says Haftar has been critical of the UN-backed government in Tripoli and its predecessor, an Islamist group that continues to hang on to some ministerial authority.
He's become a major power with the House of Representatives government in the east, but the thing is, he's getting backing from the United Arab Emirates and President al-Sisi in Egypt. He has just recently returned from the UAE, all spun up about moving forward with his own apparently personal agenda. I really believe that the governments of the UAE and Egypt and possibly a few other moderate Gulf states are hoping that Haftar can become the equivalent of al-Sisi in Libya.
White says following his release from prison in Chad 2 decades ago, Haftar moved to the United States and lived in Virginia, not far from Washington, D.C.
Oh, he's linked directly to the Central Intelligence Agency. They set him up in a villa in McLean, Virginia, for decades, and it's unclear whether he went back because of his CIA connections or his own private ambition.
Cooperation between Haftar, the Misrata militia, and the forces of the Petroleum Facilities Guard is not guaranteed, White says. He says the leader of the PFG, Ibrahim Jathran, has shown his own ambitions in the past.
Jathran, a militia warlord who once made a play for a separatist east himself, is there, and it is unclear whether Jathran and his people would cooperate with either the Misrataeen or with General Haftar if his forces get there. This is all a tremendous mess because of the different factions involved. The problem is that the factions sometimes claim to be affiliated with a legitimate government like the UN Accord government, Misrata, or with the Eastern government, Haftar, but then on the other hand act as if they have their own agenda. They cooperate with the newer government when it suits them, and they just go off and do their own thing when that's.
White says Libyan militias have tried to retake Sirte before and failed. But this time, he says the rival militias have succeeded in their first clashes with the ISIS forces.
Sirte is being squeezed once again, and the amount of coastline that ISIS controls has shrunk markedly in the past few days.
If they're to succeed this time, White says, they need to do a better job of coordination.
progress. When they get into the city, I don't know. The city, by the way, because of all this fighting, has been pretty much shattered. There really isn't a Sirte now. It's a ruin. And that actually favors the defense, because a ruined city is a perfect place for an operation like ISIS, with snipers, car bombs, and hidden mines and booby traps.
Control of Sirte will be determined in the coming days. But even if ISIS is defeated, larger questions of who leads Libya remain to be answered. David Arnold, VOA News, Washington.
It's an iconic image, African women carrying heavy jars or jerry cans of water on their heads. A new study says nearly 17 million women and children do that in 24 sub-Saharan African countries. But the study also says the age-old practice can have many adverse effects, including poor health. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
The jugs of water weigh about 18 kilograms, and women and children, mostly girls, carry them on their heads an average of more than 30 minutes per trip. Jay Graham is an assistant professor of environmental and occupational health. He and his colleagues studied traditional water collection as part of their public health research.
There has been a lot of focus on where people collect their water, so the source of their water. It's obvious why we want to do that, because, you know, if people are collecting their water from a river or a pond or lake, we know that those sources are contaminated. So there's been a lot of attention on trying to move people beyond those sources to protected sources.
Graham is with the Milken Institute of Public Health at George Washington University. He says having a protected or safe source of water is included in the new UN Sustainable Development Goals.
That's one dimension of water, but the piece that we thought was missing was this time that people are spending collecting the water. So we decided to focus on that, given that we knew that there were some data available on that issue.
He says the source of water in sub-Saharan countries and the time it takes to transport it atop one's head are critical factors affecting health.
There's a very direct impact from drinking contaminated water that's well recognized, you know, such as outbreaks of cholera. But, you know, we're just beginning to understand the impacts of that practice of carrying water long distances.
The study focused on 24 countries because they had the best data available, including death rates for children under 5 years of age. Those rates are high on the continent. Two countries, Ethiopia and Nigeria, had the most women and children involved in this labor, about 4.7 million. Graham says a water jug weighing 18 kilograms takes a toll on the human body.
Oftentimes people might carry more than that. They may take even multiple trips. So this is taking place in areas where nutrition is already a problem. They're not getting the proper energy intake that they need. And then you have this extra burden of transporting water long distances. They've documented issues with musculoskeletal damage, spinal pain, and head and neck injuries.
And then there's the matter of many children missing school because they have to carry water. The study says girls carry water 62% of the time, boys 38%.
There's a problem with inequality of men and women. Even in the United States, this is an issue. And some of these tasks, especially if it's unpaid labor, are tasks that are given to women.
The George Washington University professor gives an example of an interim solution to women carrying heavy jars of water over long distances.
Let's say we put in a protected well, that we really consider the distances of that well to the communities that will be using that well. So really thinking about that and how many access points are available so that people don't have to wait in long lines.
Even if the water source is clean, the longer it takes to transport it this way, the greater the risk of diarrheal and infectious diseases. Because the water jug is so heavy, women cannot collect enough for both cooking and hygiene, so less water for washing hands. That, for example, leads to higher levels of the bacterial eye infection, trachoma. As for long-term solutions, he says,
I think we need to challenge some of the beliefs that women are not equal to men. You know, we've done major changes in terms of people's beliefs or values around things in public health. I mean, we've seen a tremendous change in how people view smoking, for instance. And so I think we can do the same thing around equality of men and women. As we begin to say that that is not acceptable belief, then I think we can really target that.
Graham says making water collection easier and safer in developing countries would have far-reaching impacts in health, nutrition, and education. The study was published in the journal PLOS ONE. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
United Airlines announced last month that in June it will cease flights to Nigeria's largest city, Lagos. Spanish carrier Iberia recently ended its flights from Madrid. As Nigeria enters a recession due to a shortage of foreign currency and a declining oil revenue, will it become a more difficult country to travel to? VOA's Chris Stein is in Lagos and reports.
United flies daily service between Lagos and Houston, but not for much longer. Media reports say demand on the route connecting the two oil industry capitals has fallen. The airline is also having trouble converting proceeds from ticket sales in Nigeria's Naira into dollars. United is not the only airline with this problem. The International Air Transport Association says nearly $600 million in airline revenues is trapped in Nigeria. Chris Aligbe, CEO of aviation consulting firm Bellew Jane Consult, says if airlines can't get their money out of a country, they leave.
Airlines are in business to make money and to survive. And when they make money and they don't find the value in the money they are making, they will give up.
The global drop in the price of Nigeria's top export oil has caused a shortage of dollars in the country. Capital controls imposed by the government mean many companies struggle to move profits out of Nigeria. Nigerian airlines like Arik Air and Medview that fly internationally may see more passengers attracted to them, Aligbe said. These airlines can accept payments in Naira without having to worry about moving the money overseas. But these airlines will still have to settle bills in the countries they serve in foreign currency.
They are facing very serious challenges in terms of that, but they are also gaining in terms of passengers.
Foreign airlines have taken measures to reduce their exposure to Naira. Delta Airlines, for instance, doesn't accept payments in Naira for certain tickets. While they may reduce their services, Aligbe said countries with long-standing ties to Nigeria are unlikely to end their flights. Ethiopian Airlines has been flying to Nigeria since the 1960s. British Airways has also been flying to the country since it was a colony of the UK. And Turkish Airlines connects Nigeria to a country it does hundreds of millions of dollars in trade with every year.
But I know that airlines like BA will never pull out. I know that Ethiopian Airlines will not pull out. I know that Turkish Airlines will not pull out.
Nigeria's central bank announced last month that it would alter its foreign exchange policy. Details on those changes have yet to be made public. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And for stay tuned for the sunny side of sports and tune in again at 1800 for another edition of Africa News Tonight next week. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Howie Smith, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
With your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one, Ajaje. This one, Ajaje.
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best. right here on VOA Africa.